It was presidentially ordered after the Edward Snowden affair. It's chaired by the Director of National Intelligence and the Attorney General. But the National Insider Threat Task Force has information, training programs, and policy guidance useful to all agencies dealing with cybersecurity vulnerabilities posed by insiders. That is, every agency. Earlier, I discussed the task force and its work with co-director Wayne Belk.
It's made up of members of the executive branch, representatives from all the departments and agencies, and that rotates. So it's not every member of the executive branch all the time. We currently have approximately 30 people on the task force, and that's a combination of government employees and contractor personnel.
So you're full-time as co-director to coordinate all of these different agencies?
Correct. And as I mentioned, the task force is co-chaired by both the Director of National Intelligence and the Attorney General. I am the co-director for the Director of National Intelligence.
And it seems like events since that original WikiLeaks situation have proven out the need for this type of task force, and not just on the military side, but really throughout the government. But how do you define insider threat in the broader sense? Yes, there is people that are nefarious, that are stealing secrets and posting them places. This happens time and time again. But do you also incorporate the insider threat of the person who inadvertently hits on a link in a phishing email? Who's got every good intention in the world?
Absolutely. Being witting or unwitting of the threat isn't really a relevant point. The problem with insider threat is that it is kind of independent of the causes, of the causality behind it. It doesn't matter what the reason is per se. It's about activity, abnormal activity and abnormal behavior. So whether a person intends to steal information, they plug a thumb drive in and download a lot of data to exfiltrate it, or whether they inadvertently, as you point out, click on a phishing link. The results can be the same.
So one of the difficulties in watching for this kind of thing and monitoring for this kind of thing is you can't take actions as a cybersecurity person that really belong in human resources and say the disciplinary or surveillance side, where you have to have probable cause and so forth. But yet there are a lot of technical things you can do to prevent, regardless, as you say, of what the motivation might be.
Right. So that's actually the whole point of the insider threat program, because we've done the insider threat thing, whether it's loss prevention, data loss prevention, money loss prevention, whatever it is. We've done this since the beginning of time, practically. The difference is that the insider threat program brings together all of these disparate sources of information, integrates them, and then allows the analyst to put the information into context so that you know what you're looking at. If you look at the individual stovepipe functions like human resources or security or counterintelligence, they all have very legitimate purposes, but they're all very much a single functional area designed to do a single kind of thing. The Insider Threat Program is exactly the opposite of that. It brings together all of these individual things, all these individual sources of data, and integrates them.
So what are the specific activities of the task force?
The task force itself is not an operational entity. Our function is to help the executive branch departments and agencies to develop their insider threat programs that are operational within their organizations. So our job is to help them implement the national policy that includes 26 minimum standards for a minimally effective program. We help them to integrate those minimum standards into their programs.
What is the source of those standards? Is that a NIST publication, or do you have some other things?
No, it's actually another presidential document. It was signed a year later in 2012 after the executive order, and it's the National Insider Threat Policy.
What are some of the major elements of it?
Primarily, we break the 26 minimum standards, or we combine them into six categories that include technical aspects like user activity monitoring on classified networks, personnel, insider threat program personnel, their training and the requirements that they have for understanding the criticality of protecting information and the penalties for misuse of information and that type of thing, the civil liberties aspects. Then there's workforce training, having a sense of transparency of the program and having an awareness by the employee population of what the program is and what it is not.
Just knowledge of the existence of a program is often a great deterrent to what people might ordinarily do otherwise.
Absolutely. But it even goes beyond that. The awareness aspect for the employee base is not just to scare them off from doing something bad. In fact, if the program is set up appropriately, it should be there to protect the individuals in the workplace as much as it is the information on the networks. That's what you want your employee workforce to understand. You want them to know that the Insider Threat Program is there to help them, whether it be to help protect them from physical harm or whether it be to protect national security, which, of course, would be protection for them as well as a citizen of this country, right?
Now, when you mentioned, too, the physical safety, the genesis of this was a cyber incident, but do you also bridge over to the insider threat where the insider threat could be a physical threat?
There are many departments and agencies that have formally incorporated the workforce protection element into the Insider Threat Program. The only hedge I have in that answer is that the executive order that created the task force and directed the executive branch to create an insider threat program is that it is very specific to the protection of classified information on classified networks. Common sense, as you start to develop these programs, tells you that you can't separate out in a logical fashion protection of your workforce, which is primarily a security issue. You can't separate that physical or personnel security aspect out from the information protection. It just doesn't make sense. If you do that, at best, you're going to duplicate effort.
We're speaking with Wayne Belk. He's co-director of the National Insider Threat Task Force. And so the focus on the classified information that the task force has, how can that bridge over to, say, unclassified network usage, where maybe indicators of what could happen on the classified network can sometimes be found?
Right. So there's a complete recognition and understanding that you can't ignore the classified side. If nothing else, you have the danger of an individual who has access to both kinds of networks taking information from one and putting it on the other. So there's that simplistic problem. So you can't separate that out. When the executive order was first written, there was a recognition of that, but there was also a recognition of how huge a problem that would be for the federal government to try to cover all classified networks as well as all unclassified networks would have just been incredibly expensive and incredibly difficult to do all at once.
And a real mission creep.
Oh, absolutely, without a doubt. And there are differences in the protection mechanisms and in the legal protections, et cetera, between those types of systems. Obviously, a classified network, you're going to have a lot more latitude for protection of those networks and that information than you might say from a privacy perspective on the unclassified. But as I said, there is a recognition of that. And when agencies see that a lot of their crown jewels, or in some cases, most of their crown jewels are on the unclassified networks, they will put a great deal of effort into covering those networks as well. And quite honestly, in most cases, what we found is if you have built the system or the capability to protect the classified system, it's a matter of resources, not technical difficulty, in porting that over to the other side, to the unclassified side.
And getting up a level here with the task force, you offer a lot of educational and training programs that I could see at your website. Tell us about some of those.
We do offer training. It is limited to the government. It does include contractor personnel, but only those who are officially assigned to an insider threat program or in some fashion at an agency. But the task force has developed several different training programs since its inception. The current iteration is what we call a hub operations course, the hub being the central integration and analysis capability for an insider threat program. So what we train is those individuals who are either working in a hub or who are trying to build a program or who are in some way connected, the civil liberties and privacy folks, the legal folks, for example. We train them in the concepts behind operating these insider threat programs. We train them in the importance of the civil liberties protections, the whistleblower protections, and those type of things.
And this is all offered online. Do you do any in-person training? Or?
It is in person. And we hold these courses once a month, and on average once a month. And they are full. We have waiting lists months in advance for these courses.
And who attends? That is by function. I mean, who is the belly button in the agency that should be pushed to make sure this whole insider threat and classified protection keeps moving forward?
Right. So the minimum standards in the national policy actually require every department or agency that has these programs to designate one individual at a minimum as being the senior official for insider threat. And each agency has to decide for themselves where that sits in the organization. We typically push for it to be as high as possible. And somebody who has either direct control over all of those functional areas, such as security, counterintelligence, HR, those kinds of things, or at least has direct influence over those who do control them. Chief of staff comes to mind, right, in a lot of agencies. So in terms of the training, our training is open to anybody who is actually affiliated with an insider threat program. And it ranges. We have had senior officials at the senior executive level all the way through to the HR person who was assigned yesterday and is trying to figure out how to spell insider.
We're talking about federal data and classified data. Are there any best practices, though, from industry where it may not be classified, or it could be, I guess, if they're federal contractors, but say in manufacturing companies that have intellectual property that to them is their crown jewels? Are there industrial practices that can migrate to the federal context?
There absolutely are. It goes both ways, obviously. The government has learned a few lessons that we are working on passing on to industry, and vice versa. I attended a meeting of the financial sector just recently in New York City, where that was the actual function of that meeting, was to pass on best practices to kind of make sure everybody is in the same realm when we're talking about protection of our information. And as we've already discussed, it doesn't matter whether you're talking about information, money, product, intellectual property. It doesn't matter what it is. You're talking about protecting something. And the concept is essentially the same across the board.
And there are plenty of crossover points throughout industry between industry and government.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt.
All right, let's start with agencies. And they seem to be constantly reacting and putting up with bad press and all of the reputational issues and data loss issues that come from the many breaches that seem to be reported almost monthly. So what's the best advice for agencies to begin to get around in front of all of this?
The executive order that created the task force and mandated the insider threat programs across the executive branch told the task force to create a government-wide program to deter, detect, and mitigate the insider threat. Now, those three words were chosen for very specific reasons, and they were put in that order for very specific reason. Deter, of course, being the very first element. If the program is appropriately constructed and developed and the minimum standards are all put into place the way they were intended, then you're going to have a proactive program that puts emphasis on the deterrence aspect. Deterrence gets back to the awareness piece I was talking about earlier for the employee workforce. You want your workforce to know the program is there. You want them to understand generally what its function is, how it operates, and you want them to accept it as something that's there to protect them. If you can get your program to get inside that bad actor loop or that unwitting employee loop, and you can stop an individual from doing something wrong before they've gotten too far down the road, you can possibly give them assistance. You get them to an employee assistance program or something to that effect. The Insider Threat Program is not a gotcha program. It's not meant to catch everything that goes wrong in the agency. It's meant to advise and to inform the agency on the activities that are not normal across the employee workforce. Normal, of course, is a relative term. So we're not talking about strange behavior. Wayne comes to work every day and he's a quiet guy, but this week he's talking a lot. No, that's not the kind of thing we're talking about. What we're talking about is baselining what's normal activity for your workforce. Once you've baselined that, you can start to look for what's not normal. Now, part of that looking for is getting your workforce to understand they might be, individually, they might be in the exact right place to notice something that's out of the ordinary. You know the old see something, say something approach that the Department of Homeland Security
sure.
uses?
Mm-hmm.
It's the same concept. If you see that some of your coworkers are acting in a way that makes you wonder if maybe they're having a problem, something's wrong. Human nature will tell you, don't get involved. Don't get them in trouble. So we have to educate the workforce to understand that if they see something that truly gives them pause, truly causes them concern, and they report it to the Insider Threat Program, it's in an effort to get this person some help if they need it.
What are some examples of what might be a normal baseline that would pop up when it becomes abnormal?
Well, a couple of ways to answer that. One, if you're talking about technical monitoring or activity on a network.
Right, let's start with that one.
Okay. Then let's say my normal work hours are Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, and I never work on a weekend. But records indicate that for some reason, Wayne came to work Saturday morning at 2 a.m.
And the network logs would show that.
The network logs would show that. And if your system is set up such, they would automatically feed into the insider threat program.
So a user with this IP address was here on Sunday. That's an anomaly right. to the tool
right.
that sees that IP address or that network ID.
Or maybe the badge record that showed that I came in the facility, or maybe the print record right. that showed that I printed out a particular document of a particular size, a particular number of copies, et cetera, et cetera. So any one of those pieces of information on its own is nothing more than a single puzzle piece. Right, and trying to figure out what you have by looking at that puzzle piece is literally like looking at a single piece and trying to figure out what the picture on the puzzle is. So what you want to do is pull all of that kind of information into the Insider Threat Program, integrate it. If the system showed that I came in at 2 a.m. on Saturday and that's abnormal for me, then the Insider Threat Program can go, perhaps we should look to see if there's anything else abnormal. Well, yes, he came in early. He on a day that he's not usually in. He made some print jobs or whatever the issue happens to be, and you put all that together and go, there's something potentially wrong here. At that point, the insider threat personnel have to decide what to do with it,
such as looking at what it was that was printed.
Correct. And even then, you still don't have all the proper context. So it's possible in this example that the next step is to ask my supervisor, is there a reason that you had any employees in at 2 a.m. on Saturday morning? Notice I haven't even mentioned a name. That's not necessary at this point. The supervisor might go, oh, yes, I asked Wayne Buck to come in because we're whatever on Monday morning and I needed that done. Or, no, I shouldn't have had anybody in. Right. So all of that, any one of those things could be indications of abnormal activity. Put into context, you know whether you have something to be concerned about.
We're speaking with Wayne Belk, co-director of the National Insider Threat Task Force. And so those are some network activities, things that can be logged and can be flagged by tools that are set a certain way.
Right.
What about personal behavior? You often hear people that are in financial difficulty or marital difficulty can sometimes bridge over into doing things that they shouldn't do for the organization. How does that come into play?
Absolutely true. So it would be... It'd be extremely difficult to try to educate your employees to know exactly what to look for in terms of somebody who is going to compromise classified information, for example.
People don't like playing shrink.
Right, exactly. So you want to be very careful not to try to turn your workforce into an every time something bothers me, I call the insider threat people. Right? That's not what you want. This is not a Big Brother program. We're not trying to turn the workforce against each other. It's exactly the opposite. But we all have that sense, that personal sense of the people that we work with on a day-to-day basis. And sometimes you don't even have to be working with them daily. You might be in that particular office once a week or something like that. But you will have a sense if something doesn't feel right or doesn't look right or doesn't sound right. It's left up to the individuals as to what thresholds they set to make that notification. But we always want to notify, or we always want to educate the workforce that if they do see, feel, hear, think something is just not right, don't try to figure it out. Call the Insider Threat Program and let them figure it out. Remember, the Insider Threat Program is not a gotcha program. A call to them doesn't equal black helicopters swoop in, you know, Bill disappears, never to be seen again. That is not how the programs are constructed.
Now, there are tools that can take material like email, text with an email or text messages, phone calls even, and dissect meaning and context out of that kind of mass of data. That's not quite wiretapping, but it's taking the accumulated information and looking at it. At what point does that become into play, or does it ever, in insider threat program?
Well, phone calls and monitoring of telephone conversations are not part of the minimum standards under the executive order and the national policy. So the insider threat program has no element in it within those requirements that deals with telephone conversations. So I would refer you to other aspects of agencies for that particular authority and function. When it comes to monitoring of things like text messaging, emails, those kinds of things. Remember, again, we're talking specifically about the classified networks. Monitoring of classified networks is very much based on consent by the employee. So the legal folks...
Monitoring of classified or of unclassified?
Monitoring of classified networks.
Of classified.
Yes, mm-hmm. is very much on a consent basis. So the legal folks, the civil liberties and privacy folks have all vetted all of the rules and regulations and procedures of an agency for that kind of monitoring. The employees are all notified through many different ways, through training and education, through banners on their screens, through monitoring consent forms, any number of ways that they are notified of what privacies they can expect and what privacies they cannot expect on these networks. So that kind of monitoring is something that, as I say, is well vetted.
Because most people I've spoken to that work on classified networks, they acknowledge, I don't have any privacy here. I've given that away as a result of working on classified. We all buy into this. We all understand because of the mission and so forth. So
right.
That means you can get at that. But is there any way, suppose, you know, the classic example, on the unclassified, you tell Boris you'll meet him at the park at 6 with the bag or something like that. You know, I'm sort of pulling together from some very old cases. but can it bridge over to that if there's sufficient suspicion?
It certainly can. Again, those kinds of things are not within the executive order or the national policy.
Got it.
However, as we discussed before, a lot of the departments and agencies are leveraging other authorities that they may have, whether it be security or counterintelligence or some sort of investigative authority in terms of law enforcement agencies or something like that. They're leveraging those, and in a lot of cases, they're linking those to the Insider Threat Program. There's absolutely nothing wrong with doing it that way, and that would give you that bridge that you're talking about to be able to look into the unclassified side.
So in other words, for a comprehensive program from an agency standpoint, they should take what you're doing and really integrate it into whatever else they might be doing to create a kind of an overall picture to protect themselves.
Right. Integration absolutely is the key. Integration and context are my two favorite words for an insider threat program.
So the task force now is in its fifth or sixth year. What's your evidence that you're having an effect across the government?
Well, one of the things that the executive order tells the task force to do is to conduct independent assessments of these department agencies' programs as they're developing. So we've conducted approximately 78 assessments to date since about the beginning of 2014 when we started the assessment program. We are seeing evidence of progress in many of those. A lot of these, like I said earlier, these programs have been around forever. You know, you can pick some of the larger intelligence community agencies and they can show you that they've been doing these functions for 40 years or whatever. The difference is the national focus and the minimum standards and those types of things. So even the big ones that have been doing this for a long time still have work to do to meet those standards as they were written and intended. So they're taking what exists, what functions, what has worked for a long time, and they're modifying them to meet the current standards. So what the task force does then is, once we've conducted an assessment, we will make recommendations to that agency for what they need to improve, and then we will feed that back into our assistance program. So we have a feedback loop that goes back to the rest of the task force where we help them with, whether it be technical, policy, training, whatever the issues are, we provide assistance. Where the task force can't provide that direct support, we will set up mentoring relationships with other departments or agencies who've either already been there, done that on that problem, or they're currently working that problem. And we'll set up small working groups or communities of interest to work particular kinds of issues.
Now, in terms of incidents, these run the gamut from the Edward Snowdens, who are deliberate takers of information. But over the years, we've heard cases, you know, a laptop is left in a car, a tape from a computer even is left in the car and taken. Out of 100 incidents that you hear about, what percentage would you say is malicious insiders versus just simply dumb mistakes that people make?
I like to use the term stupid human tricks. And honestly, that is the vast majority of what an insider threat program is going to see. The espionage cases are the small fraction of what you actually see happening. And it's like a plane crash, right? the odds of a plane crash happening are very small relative to the rest of the transportation industry. But what do you hear the most about? What's the biggest news? Right? So it's a similar concept.
Wayne Belk is co-director of the National Insider Threat Task Force. We'll post the entire interview at federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive.